Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 164 of Wheat All About It, the second part of what I'm calling the episode about the biggest threat to Pacific Northwest production agriculture, two. My recording of a panel discussion that took place during the 2019 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention on November 15, 2019. Although I've produced several podcasts about herbicide weed resistance and written about it in Wheat Life multiple times, this episode, 164, is the first time I've addressed a solution outside the usual rotate your modes of action advice. Katie Densman is a postdoctoral research associate in the Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology Department at the University of Idaho, and sociology, as it turns out, is the perfect specialty for studying and hopefully solving the herbicide-resistant conundrum. Densman was the third speaker on the herbicide-resistant panel following WSU weed scientists Ian Burke and Drew Lyon, heard in last week's episode. When Densman was introduced as a sociologist, my ears perked up. It's rare you meet a sociologist in agricultural circles, but when you think about it, there should be more of them. Consider one definition of sociology: a social science involving the study of the social lives of people, groups, and societies. Farmers are certainly a specific group of people, and their social lives, that is, their interactions with other farmers, may be the key to finding the cure for herbicide-resistant weeds. Community-based management is the term Densman uses to describe part of the solution, which involves farmers taking action together, because if a neighbor has a herbicide-resistant weed, you're going to get it too. Densman isn't new to this line of work. Resistance problems began showing up in the Midwest long before the Northwest, and she got her PhD at the University of Michigan 6 years ago with a doctorate that looked in part at solutions to herbicide resistance by looking at the human mechanism. Densman began her presentation by describing a common pool resource, which in this case is the shared susceptibility of weeds to herbicides. Individuals can upset that shared susceptibility, however, and wind up hurting everyone. Densman began by explaining a common pool resource.
A common pool resource is basically just a shared resource. It's a public good and it's unregulated. And you have to self-regulate it for the benefit of the entire group. So when an individual overuses a certain resource, it's depleted for everyone. And the classic example of this is kind of fishing grounds, where if you have one person who's just taking a ton of fish out of the water, then all of a sudden you're going to deplete that population, there's going to be fewer fish for everyone, and all of a sudden you've used up that resource, which is known as the tragedy of the commons. And so something we are wondering is, does herbicide susceptibility constitute a common pool resource? And our argument is that it does, because weed susceptibility to herbicides is a shared resource among a bunch of people. It's unregulated, and it can be used up by an individual to the detriment of the group. So if one farmer is not controlling their weeds and they get herbicide resistance and they're not doing enough to control that, then it's going to spread to other people and negatively impact them as well. And one of the fundamental parts of a common pool resource is we're trying to figure out how we can actually regulate that. And there's a couple different ways in the literature that people have found to regulate a common pool resource so that you get even spread and everyone's taking care of it and you don't have one person using it up too much. And the first option is to privatize the resource if that's possible. For herbicide susceptibility, not really. Option two is external regulation. So you get the government coming in and making regulations. I don't think that farmers are going to like that as an option based on some of the research that I have done. Option three is community-based management. And so that's kind of where we see this going as an option for managing herbicide resistance. And in the literature, there's a couple conditions in a community that help set the stage for a good community-based management, a successful community-based management initiative. The first is awareness of the effects that others' actions have on one's own welfare. So just being aware that how other people manage herbicide resistance and manage their weeds is going to impact you. The second is communication between resource users. So how much do you actually talk to your neighbors and coordinate your efforts? And then finally is the recognition of the need for cooperation to prevent resource exhaustion. So you've got awareness, communication, and recognition of the need for cooperation. And so what we did is we looked at, are these three conditions met for herbicide resistance? We did a couple different data collection methods to see, is community-based management even possible? And so in 2015 and 16, we did a series of focus groups, 10 groups in Iowa, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Arkansas, and I'll present some of the results from that. In 2016, we did a national survey with about 900 respondents. And in 2018, we did a survey in the Pacific Northwest with about 100 respondents. And these were surveys of farmers. And so first, I'm going to look at the first condition for community-based management, which is awareness. And so to measure awareness, we looked at the variable concern about herbicide-resistant weeds spreading from neighbors. So this was a question on the survey, and this is something we talked about in the focus groups as well. Are you concerned about this? And in the national survey, 71% of our respondents said, yes, we are concerned about herbicide resistance spreading from our neighbors. In the Pacific Northwest, it was 80%. So we're actually doing a little better here, which is awesome. And then in the focus groups, I have some quotes that are representative of what people were saying. And so in Iowa, we had somebody say, we know our neighbor has it. It's a matter of time, probably really short time, until we have it. In Arkansas, you know your neighbor's weeds are your weeds too. Let's not kid ourselves. In Minnesota, the first participant said, if they're in the neighbor's fields, the wind blew them into yours last winter, or the birds picked them up. If they're in an area, they're all over the area. And then somebody else said, the only reason this group has resistant weeds is because of their neighbors, obviously. So there's a fairly good awareness that what your neighbor is doing is impacting what your herbicide resistance problem is going to be like. And then what we did additionally with the national survey data is we looked at what factors influence an increase in that awareness or an increase in that concern. And so these things increased awareness, belief in herbicide-resistant weed mobility, concern about multiple resistant weeds, the influence of extension educators. So if they got a lot of information from extension educators, they were more aware of the mobility of weeds between neighbors. And there are a couple of things that decreased concern and awareness as well. And those were having inadequate time to manage weeds, so you just don't have the time to think about it. And operator age, that was a significant effect, but it was a very small effect. And so the next condition is communication. Do you talk to your neighbors? Do you talk to your community about this issue? And so we had a question asking people if they discuss herbicide-resistant weed problems with their neighbors. In the U.S., 56% of people said they do. In the Pacific Northwest, 60%. So again, a little higher in the Pacific Northwest. And then we have some quotes. And honestly, people thought this was pretty difficult to do. People said, if you live in town, it'd just be like telling your neighbor, you didn't mow your grass when I did, or something. Or your house isn't the right color. I mean, it's the same thing. And in Iowa, again, somebody said, my answer would be nothing. I don't see myself going up and knocking on the door and saying, you need to get rid of your weeds. And I think that's probably going to be a typical answer. Another person saying, but to just go up and volunteer, that's a little overstepping. And so a lot of people actually did want to communicate, and they said, I'd like to know what my neighbors are doing. Or I have a neighbor who's a problem, and it'd be great if I could talk to them about it. But it was difficult to kind of find that venue, because they didn't want to be unwelcome or make a problem with their neighbor. So then the last condition was recognizing a need for cooperation. And so for this variable, we looked at agreement that herbicide resistance must be managed cooperatively. In the U.S. nationally, we had 61% say yes. In the Pacific Northwest, we had 67%. And then in the focus groups, we had people saying, well, I haven't been using Roundup on corn. I still have to worry about resistant weeds because of what the neighbors have done. One person can't solve the problem. It's all our problem, whether we caused it or not. In Minnesota, I think it's everybody's problem. In Arkansas, this was really interesting because in Arkansas, we talked to people who had actually started a community resistance management program, the zero tolerance program, and this was that group of people. And they said they did it by just trying to get all the neighbors around you to try and go in together and make sure that there's no pigweed. And they said, yeah, it's all voluntary, but if your neighbor's cleaner, that's going to help you be clean. And in Minnesota, they said, I don't think we want laws. We don't want the government to do it for us. No. I think we need to do it ourselves. So again, going back to that option for managing common pool resources, you have the external regulation option, but I think that farmers would prefer the community management option. And things that decreased agreement was this thing we're calling techno-optimism, which is basically the belief that a new miracle herbicide is going to come out and fix it, and you won't have to use integrated practices or anything like that. So if you believe that, you probably don't think that cooperative action is needed. And then personal mobility. So basically, if you think you can just move somewhere else, you don't really care about the farm you're on all that much. So where do we stand? There's some things that are beneficial for community action, which are great, especially in the Pacific Northwest. We had higher ratings on all of these factors than the U.S. more generally, which sets us up very nicely. There's really high awareness of the common pool nature of herbicide resistance. And over half of respondents said they communicate with their neighbors about herbicide resistance and see cooperative management as necessary. So we have a really good basis there. We also found that extension is very influential and that's really working, which is very nice. Some barriers we have, still 40% of respondents talked to their neighbors never or infrequently about herbicide resistance. So even though over half do, that's a pretty substantial percentage that don't. And that's reflected in the focus groups by they're saying how difficult this can really be. There's this concern about overstepping and the fact that, like, we're very individual. I can't tell somebody else how to farm. And if I have weeds, I can't tell my neighbor what to do. And then it's also just hard to get to neighbors that are considered problem neighbors. They're the ones that aren't coming to these meetings anyway, so how do we enroll those people? And then we also had 33% that didn't think cooperative management is necessary. Techno-optimism, belief that a new herbicide would come out was a problem. So what can we do? Well, part of what we're trying to do is we're starting to kind of create this community management initiative in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm excited that you're here because that's part of what we're doing. We're doing a series of listening sessions to kind of figure out in more detail what resources specific communities in the Pacific Northwest have to kind of start these community management programs. What are the specific barriers? What are the ways and the resources we can draw on to actually do this? We're also trying to organize a variety of listening sessions in the region. So if anyone is interested in getting a group together, I'll run it if you'll get the people.
I know Steve Riggers, but only by his reputation. And his reputation is as an excellent farmer and curious guy. He spoke not just about his experiences with herbicide resistance, but with the history of herbicides in general. He began by commenting on the large turnout of farmers and others to learn about the issue of herbicide resistance.
Obviously, the issue of herbicide resistance has gotten some people's attention. I view this as a very serious threat to agriculture and the PNW. Obviously, there's a lot of pressures right now on farming. Low prices, reminds me a lot of the 80s. I came back to farm in 1982, and a lot of things, what goes around comes around. We're looking at some tough times, and this is just another problem that really makes it a little bit scary. So I'm gonna go back, kind of give you a perspective. Obviously, I don't have the technical background that these other folks do, but what I do have is some perspective as a grower of about 40 years, and I just wanted to go back to look at some of the things I saw in my career and how I think it kind of funneled us towards this problem, because I think there's some events that occurred that kind of just pointed in this direction, and it's been hard to, at the time, to really know what was going on, but looking back on it, it makes a lot of sense. So, I remember coming home from high school one day and my dad telling me that there was a new chemical out called Roundup that, lo and behold, would kill Canada thistle, quack grass. Problem was, it was about $80 a gallon, but it was a huge breakthrough, and it was one of those sea change things that Ian talked a little bit about. Huge thing for agriculture. I don't think our farm would be where it is without Roundup. We're a direct seed farm, and without it, it would never have happened. So up until about 1980, we were very reliant on on things like 2,4-D, dicamba, MCPA, and those are starting to lose their appeal. You always had the potential for crop injury with those, but lo and behold, late 70s, early 80s, DuPont comes out with the first generation of sulfonylurea herbicides. Glean was the first one, and it was an absolute godsend. You know, it was economical, and it had tremendous efficacy on the weeds that we were trying to kill. Easy to handle, very gentle on the crop, just an amazing breakthrough. And along with that came out the first generation of ACC-ACE inhibitors, the group ones, the Holon. I don't know how many of you guys, this is something the younger than 40 crowd's probably going to really needs to pay attention here, because the older guys, we remember some of this stuff. The Holon came out. It was a dynamite herbicide for taking grassy weeds out of cereal crops. We rode that wave. We've been riding that wave. We're still riding that wave. We're still depending on those group ones and group twos as a foundation for our weed control in grain farming systems in the Pacific Northwest. That was a big deal. And along with that, in the 80s, we had oversupply. We had a lot of economic pressures on farming. And I think it led to a couple things. One of the things was set-asides came around in the 80s, and they were tied directly to farm subsidies. So there was the government told you how many acres you could plant of a given crop, and there was a lot of fallow because you really didn't have a choice. You could only plant so many acres of barley, so many acres of wheat. And I think that in some ways was a good thing because it kind of kept us from going more and more towards a monoculture, which I think is one of the huge problems you get into when you're looking at herbicide resistance. Freedom to Farm Act in 1995, it basically decoupled farm subsidies from the grower, from the farm. You could plant whatever you wanted to. And I think that was overall a good thing. I was a big fan of Freedom to Farm. But it also allowed growers to gravitate more towards a monoculture, and we saw more and more acres of recrop wheat, those kinds of things, which I think put pressure on us when it came to herbicide resistance. And then lo and behold, in the mid-90s, the first transgenic Roundup Ready crops came into being. And, it was corn, soybeans, cotton became huge. And if you look at the total amount of soybeans and corn in the country, of 180 million acres approximately, and you look at cotton, it was a huge disincentive for the chemical manufacturers to continue to invest dollars in research and discovery of new herbicides, especially for wheat. Like it or not, wheat is still pretty much a minor crop. And if you're in a pulse rotation or canola, that set the stage for disinvestment into new herbicides, modes of action in the grain industry. I think another thing that happened was we saw farms getting bigger in the 90s, in the early 2000s. We no longer had a situation where most of the land that was being farmed was by the owner-operator. All of a sudden, we're seeing farms expanding and a lot of turnover in land. So the stewards of the land, it was ever-changing. And I don't think that was boded well for long-term stewardship of some of these products that we use now. 2001, Clearfield wheat comes along. And this was a godsend, especially for people that were battling join-and-go grass, other problem weeds. It was the first generation, the single gene resistance was problematic because it was tricky. You always had the possibility of crop injury, but it was a breakthrough. And then with the two gene resistance, it was a fantastic addition to what we were doing. But the problem, as probably a lot of is that, the Clearfield technology using a Mazamox chemistry, it's in the same group as the other ALS herbicides, the group 2s. So even though it's different, it still presents a lot of potential problems for developing resistance to those chemistries. And then in the mid-2000s, Osprey PowerFlex, probably all of you know when that came about. There's another generation very effective at taking grassy weeds out of cereal crops, which is always the trick. I mean, it's pretty easy to take broadleafs out of cereal crops, but taking grassy weeds out is a problem. But again, these two chemistries are in that group 2 family. And that's, so you see the pattern. We're highly reliant on the group 1s and group 2s. And, you know, I think we've come to a tipping point. And the last event that I'll mention is what a lot of ag economists call the super cycle, which was that 3 or 4 years of farming where farmers were making bank. It just seemed like the cash was flowing into the farm. You couldn't make a mistake. There was margins were high. Yields were good, at least in the PNW. We had some good weather during that time. Farmers made a lot of money, and there was a huge incentive to plant wheat. And, you know, wheat was, you know, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 bucks a bushel. Why plant anything else? And so I know in the area I come from, there was a tremendous amount of recropping, wheat after wheat after wheat, and the reliance on whether it was the Clearfield system or using Osprey PowerFlex to take those weeds out. And it's been about 10 years since those, or 15 years since those chemistries came out, and a lot of we're starting to see problems with that. I don't know how many. My biggest concern, we've got, you know, herbicide-resistant Italian ryegrasses in our area. We have group 1 resistant wild oats in places. But my biggest concern right now is if you look at things like GoGrass, wild oat, cheatgrass, downy brome, is, you know, we've been relying on these group 2s, and we've been hoping that we could control joint and goldgrass with these chemistries. And I think we're looking at a situation where we've used those things enough consistently that we're probably looking at some problems, no doubt about it. And it's serious. I don't think there's anything, a bigger threat to ag right now as from a production standpoint than dealing with herbicide resistance. I think there's a lot of strategies we can use. I'm guardedly optimistic that we can hold the line on this thing. But I'll tell you what, mistakes are going to be costly. And if this thing continues to accelerate the direction we're going, I think this is going to take farms out. I think this one issue alone will cause a lot of pressures on a lot of family farms.
Next up was Doug Finkelberg, a University of Idaho extension educator who supports dryland cropping systems in North Idaho. He began his presentation with the admission that extension's traditional approach to solving problems has not worked in the case of herbicide weed resistance.
I'd like to start out by admitting that extension in this case has been an absolute, well, not absolute, but attempts to date to get ahead of herbicide resistance using our typical extension model of bringing about best management practices, explaining them, and assuming that they'll be taken forth and conquered with, has been a failure. It has not worked. And I think we've been seeing a very well-articulated path for this failure of getting ahead of this issue. Quite simply, when it comes to doing the things that are necessary to get ahead of herbicide resistance, most people can't afford to, or they believe they can't afford to. I would clean my combine before I took it to the next field adequately, but I don't have time for that. I would tarp my loads. I would make efforts not to spread grassy weeds down the road while I'm moving residues, straws, things like that, but I don't have time for that. It's going to take me more labor hours. It's going to take more than I'm willing to put in because I've got an operation to run, and I don't have time for that. So, you know, we know what will happen if we don't do any. If we continue to do what we're doing, we're going to burn through the remaining chemistries. We're going to be waiting for the next magic bullet to come out. When it does, like with peroxisulfone, Zidua, Anthem Flex, we're going to burn through it as fast as we can because it'll be the only thing that'll work in some scenarios. And it doesn't have to be the only thing that works across the whole PNW. It just has to be the only thing that a few people know will work for them. And then they develop the weeds, and the weeds move around. And this is the pattern that we continue to see. So, you know, that's what we're looking at if we don't do anything different than what we're doing right now, is we're going to continue to see this problem get worse. I think Drew and Ian did a great job of outlining the challenges to new chemistries coming out. We do have technologies we can rely on. Herbicide-resistant crops are a great tool and play a great role in the solutions to this. The solutions aren't that complicated. It's just we haven't figured out how to incorporate them into an economically viable set of strategies that we can apply at the farm level. We know we should increase our sanitation. We know we should rotate our crops. We know we should rotate our modes of action, that we should combine our modes of action. We know these things. We just can't always afford to do them, right? So if we're going to be successful, if we're going to have a shared sense of community, and with that sense of community, a shared sense of obligation to each other, we will figure out how to make the right thing economically viable. And that's the piece that's missing right now, but that I think is attainable through a regional herbicide-resistant weeds initiative. The solutions are going to look different in different places because we're farming in unique environments, different range or different rain patterns, different microenvironments. But we can learn from each other, and that's what we need to do. We need to increase the amount of communication that we have so that when a solution is hit upon in one area, it can be quickly disseminated to other areas. So that we, because this is, the clock is ticking on this issue. Clock is ticking. We need more flexible policy. We need to have folks from RMA in discussions with us so that we can adjust conservation programs, perhaps, in order to pull out the plow when it's appropriate and not when it's not. There will be adjustments that will need to be made in people's philosophies and policies. But starting with this sense of community and obligation is, I think, the start of changing what has been a very individualistic mindset, because it's going to take the expertise of private industry, working with universities, networks of information transfer. It's going to take policymakers coming to the table and being willing to listen and adjust. But this isn't very different. This whole conference is based around people coming together and advocating for common interests. This interest just needs to be raised to that level of concern. And we need to recognize that together we can actually move forward with this. So what we really need to do, if this regional initiative will be successful, what that's going to look like is a change of mindset from I can't afford to do it right to focusing on resistant management is vital to my farm's sustainability and economic viability in the long term.
After I hear presentations like the two highlighted in episodes 163 and 164, I wish my audience of farmers was larger. Communication only works when people hear you. Hello? Please encourage your neighbors, landlords, agribusiness friends, and others to listen to these two episodes, which I entitled The Episode About the Biggest Threat to Pacific Northwest Production Agriculture. The edited recording of a panel presentation on herbicide resistance held during the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention, November 15, 2019. Please join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.